Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Policy Agendas podcast, a podcast by the Policy Agendas Project, which is a lot of P's and a lot of alliteration. My name is EJ Fagan. I'm the project manager of the Policy Agendas Project. Today, I am joined by Katie Madel.
Madel.
I'm sorry, Katie. I'm terrible pronouncing names. So Katie, another graduate student here. Can you introduce yourself?
My name's Katie Madel. I study public policy. Specifically, I'm interested in political communication, education policy, and gender politics.
Yeah. And so we're going to have a bit of a revolving cast here on this podcast, mostly graduate students from the project, but also faculty members here at the University of Texas at Austin. The goal is to interview political scientists doing new work in the realm of public policy and defining public policy broadly. We want to talk about the discipline. We want to talk about the work. We want to talk about the implications of the work, et cetera. Being at the Policy Agendas Project, we're always very interested in data here, which we'll talk about. We'll be mixing together people who are with the University of Texas, so people who can come in here and talk with us on studio, and also other political scientists from around the country. For this first episode, Katie, can you tell us what is on the agenda?
We will be talking to Dr. Derek Epp, who is an assistant professor here at the University of Texas, on his 2018 book, The Structure of Policy Change.
So what's this book about? It's got a big title, but that title can mean a lot of things.
Derek focuses on the differences between collective decision-making and deliberative decision-making.
It's a fascinating book. It's almost like a psychology book in addition to be a public policy punctuated equilibrium book.
Yeah, he uses a lot of budget data to look at how these decisions are made.
Yeah, it's really great. I'm excited to play the episode, and that's going to follow this. But first, let me just have a couple of quick announcements. So this is our first episode. We're really excited to hear what you think about this episode. So if you have any feedback, if there's any people you think we should be interviewing, if there's questions we should ask, if, you know, my voice is annoying, whatever, email us at policyagendas@gmail.com or tweet at us at policyagendas. If you like the podcast, if that feedback is positive, please leave us a rating on iTunes if you can. That helps people discover the show. Please share it with your colleagues and friends. We really think this podcast has potential. We think that the discipline has a hole for people discussing new work, and we think it's a lot of fun. And so we're really excited to share it with you. And with that note, next up is our interview with Professor Derek Epp on the structure of policy change. We are now joined by Derek Epp. Derek is an assistant professor of government here at the University of Texas at Austin. He is author of the book we are going to discuss today, The Structure of Policy Change. Derek, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here, Katie and EJ. I really appreciate being the first guest on your very exciting podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. And Derek is also heavily involved in the Policy Agendas Project here at UT. And so he's a familiar face. He's the perfect person to get this started. And we're going to start talking about the structure of policy change. So, Derek, I'd just like you to, first, for the listeners who haven't read this maybe or about to pick it up, can you summarize this book? What is the argument you make in the structure of policy change?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a book that is, first of all, I had to write a dissertation when I was a graduate student at UNC. And so this is the final culmination of that dissertation project. But the book looks at how governments process information and what the consequences are for how policies change over time. And so pretty much from the get-go, studying agenda setting, studying policy process, people have been interested in how do policies change over time, and there's been a lot of developments in that area. So if you talk about famous studies, for example, E.E. Schatzschneider, conflict expansion, the three streams approach by Kingdon, you have your garbage can model. And one of the important innovations in this field of study is what has been known as the punctuated equilibrium theory. And this was actually developed by one of our professors here at UT, Brian Jones, along with his colleague, Frank Baumgartner, who is at UNC. And they borrow the name punctuated equilibrium from biology. And this is the idea that change can go through long periods of what is temporary equilibrium. And then you'll have brief periods of very dramatic change. And so what they observed is that policies, when we looked at policies, whether we focus on a particular policy area, like nuclear energy, like pesticides, like NASA, whatever the area was, or if we aggregated outwards and we looked at the entire federal government's budget, we would find what they termed this punctuated equilibrium pattern, which is to say a lot of stasis, a lot of very low-level changes, and then a few really dramatic overhauls where the government appears to dramatically rethink the way it's going to approach an issue. And so the question that they were interested in is why do we observe this? And this is actually something that scholars of the policy process have been struggling with for a long time. We had theories that did a good job of explaining the punctuations, and that would be things like the policy windows, again, Kingdon. We had theories that did a good job of explaining the incrementalism, and that would be like Wadowski and his theory of incrementalism. Punctuated equilibrium is the first to put them together in a really nice way. And what Jones and Baumgartner told us is that it comes down to basically frictions or roadblocks that act on the policy process. And they identified institutional roadblocks and also cognitive ones. And these are simply things that disrupt how governments are going to process information. So rather than sort of continuously and proportionally updating to new information that happens in the world, governments become stuck on a certain idea or a certain dimension of a problem. They really overinvest in that dimension. And then as time passes and the policy solutions have settled on become further out of step with the world, when they do get around to revising that policy, the changes can be really dramatic. So that's sort of the jumping off point for where the book gets involved. And what I was curious in is what are some particular mechanisms within government that affect how institutions and policymakers can process information? And what we would expect is some types of institutions allow for more proportional processing of information, and others it's going to be more intermittent. And so the words that is typically used in conjunction with this theory is disproportionate information processing. And in the book, I decide that it really comes down to three different things. There's the capacity of governments to process information. And this is things like how much research capacity does a government have? How professional is the legislature? How much support staff do policymakers have? What is their ability to really engage with information and try to find solutions to problems? And so all of that is capacity. And then I look at complexity. Some issues are simply more complex than others. Shark attacks are very complex. We don't know how to predict when a shark is going to bite somebody. So that's a complex issue if you're going to try and solve that. On the other hand, something like old age is conceptually very simple. We know how old the population is. We know how old it's going to be tomorrow. And so that would be, that's complexity, complex issues, simple issues. And then the third area that I focus on, and this to me, I think is perhaps one of the more innovative areas of the book is to look at what I term collective decision making. And so I draw a distinction between deliberative processes, and these are what most of us are familiar with. So if you're a member of a group and you have to figure out how are we going to allocate our time or resources, you would engage in a deliberative process. And in fact, most of the policy making that we see is done through this deliberative process where people meet in a room, they debate, maybe they vote. All of that I term deliberation. And I draw a contrast with what could be termed collective or disaggregated decision making, which is when you have a lot of semi-autonomous actors who all make their own decisions, and then the final outcome that we might measure is the collective output of all those independent decisions. So the quintessential example of this would be a stock market. And I make the case that these aggregation gains that you see in things like the stock market allow those systems to process information much more efficiently than you might commonly observe from the deliberative processes. Neither of them are perfect. There are still cognitive frictions that act on both the collective and the deliberative decision making, but the collective decision making can circumvent that to some extent.
So your dependent variable here is instability or policy punctuations, however you want to say it. Why is this a dependent variable that we should care about? Why does it matter that we can predict when some systems will be more stable and some will be more unstable?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple of answers to that. One is simply that's what one of the things we're interested in as political scientists. And it actually tells us, I think, a lot about sort of fundamentally how do governments operate? Are they meticulously updating in response to new information, or are they surprised a lot? And when we observe a system that is producing a whole lot of punctuations, a whole lot of stasis, that would appear to be a system that is surprised a lot, which is to say that problems are getting better or worse, but those changes in the problem streams are not being smoothly translated into policy outputs. And so I think it speaks directly to the kind of governance that we receive and what we can expect from government. It doesn't mean that the government can't solve problems, but we should be realistic about government's ability to quickly adapt to problems. And there's lots of examples. So there's tons of problems that we can identify, and we say, why isn't the government doing something about that? But but that to a large extent is part of the system. And so that's what the book is actually looking at, is trying to understand under what conditions could the government perhaps respond more quickly to things that we might identify as problems, things like climate change, things like immigration. These are issues that for a lot of people are calling out for some attention, and they're not getting them. And so this book tries to answer, well, why might that be the case?
So how does your discussion on collective decision-making come into this?
Right. So the collective decision-making, so this is a literature on punctuated equilibrium that had focused on basically whatever type of governmental system, we would observe this same dichotomy between stasis and punctuation. And it was such a reliable finding that I think a bunch of people published an article called The General Empirical Law of Public Budgets, which was simply saying that budgets follow, no matter where you look, at what level, what country, they follow this punctuated equilibrium pattern, a lot of small level changes, a few really big ones. So that's unusual. You don't find a lot of political scientists publishing articles called The General Empirical Law. We usually save that for, you know, the natural sciences. And so there was this big question out there, well, is there anything that can kind of get around this? Is there any area where we see less of a dichotomy between stasis and punctuation? And I think that the collective decision-making offers us perhaps our best bet on that regard. So when you look at distributions of changes coming from these collective processes, you tend to find a much lower level of punctuation than you do from your typical deliberative process. Now, that's not to say that punctuations never happen, and we know this from the stock market. I mean, the housing market collapse, that's a punctuation in the stock market. But that kind of thing is less common from your collective systems than it is from your deliberative system.
You have a whole chapter testing different systems or situations with this collective decision making. Can you summarize those a little bit?
Right. So the first thing I wanted to do, and this might actually be the next chapter in the book, but than the one you're talking about. But first, I want to draw a distinction between a lot of people, when they hear sort of market systems or collective decision making, they think, well, private firms. And so they think, well, shouldn't we just privatize government services? But I want to carefully make the point in the book that the decision-making that takes place within a firm, I would consider deliberative. Those are decisions that are about how we are going to allocate resources that would take place in a boardroom. That's very different than the kind of decision-making we would observe from a market, which is a bunch of quasi-independent investors trying to make some money. And so I was trying to look at how can government integrate not so much privatization, which I think is different, but market systems. And so look at a few instances of deregulation. So for example, the deregulation of airlines. I spent quite a bit of time talking about regional cap and trade programs, which is the government trying to sort of impose a market collective on a policy output. And then the biggest example is monetary policy and exchange rates. And this is obviously an important area of policymaking. Exchange rates are important. And some countries, like historically China, has sort of artificially held their exchange rate at a certain level. And so they would decide within the Chinese Politburo what level they think is appropriate for the exchange rate to try and achieve whatever economic goals they might have. And that is different than a country like the United States, which lets their exchange rate fluctuate freely on the market. And you observe a really profound difference in the distribution of changes, depending on whether you're looking at the free-floating currencies like the United States and a lot of the Western democracies versus the countries that are artificially manipulating their exchange rates. So I thought this was an important chapter because even having identified this collective decision-making, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a huge role for it in policymaking. And so I wanted to illustrate that there are some key areas where it can be a big part of the process.
In that chapter 8, you also analyze the difference between the decision making of public firms versus private firms,
right,
or public organizations versus private organizations, and different types of those organizations. And what you show is that in terms of expenditures when you're comparing, for example, private colleges versus public colleges, or you're comparing the United States postal system versus UPS and FedEx, that there's no difference between in the distribution of changes for those private firms. So this feels like a fairly profound and important finding. And I'm curious, I mean, are you taking a shot at Adam Smith right here, right? Is this you saying that the invisible hand might not be, you know, that the information conveyed from the market to firms does not produce efficient outcomes or more efficient outcomes than a lot of the privatization people, people who support privatization, tend to believe.
No, definitely nothing. Not doing anything as ambitious as taking shots at Adam Smith. I'm actually a big believer in the book with the efficient market hypothesis. And I think that's, I mean, the reason that you find fewer punctuations from markets is because I think they are informationally efficient. That fits pretty directly with the distinction I'm trying to make between collective decision-making and deliberative ones. But the point is simply that firms may be publicly traded on a market, but that's still the way that they're going to allocate resources within the firm. That's not necessarily a collective process. That's the same type of process, I mean, whatever goes on in their boardroom, presumably some sort of deliberation. And so the point I'm making in the book is that those conversations that are happening in the boardroom are not necessarily any more informationally efficient than what you would find in the public service. And so when we compare areas where there's both areas of the economy where there's both a government service like mail delivery and also a private service like FedEx, we find about the same level of punctuations in how they're spending their money in both of these areas.
But this does imply that, for example, I might not see many gains in efficiency if I decide to privatize a service.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And so that's, I think the book is pretty skeptical. And I want to be clear, I'm just talking about, you know, this is a huge literature, and I'm just talking here about informational efficiency. So there may be a major argument for privatization that relies on other areas. But I think there's no real clear argument that firms, at least from what I've shown in the book, that firms are going to be inherently better at processing information than governments would be. And I think that's because both of them are relying on this pretty deliberative way of allocating resources. Now, that, you know, it may be that if we look at the areas in which firms are involved, that those tend to be less complicated areas. And that's an argument that's been made, is that government maybe looks inefficient because we give government all the hard problems. That's why we have government in the first place. So I can't rule that out. But I can say that when you compare something where, you know, the same industry where both the government and the firm is involved, it doesn't look like, in terms of their ability to process information, the private sector is doing any better. So higher education is a great example of that. And you see, if you look at how, you know, private universities are allocating their budgets, you see, actually, it's an even more pronounced dichotomy between doing nothing and then making really radical changes than you see at public universities.
I do want to come back to this public university and education example. First, though, can you explain efficiency? Because I think that can mean a lot of things.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And so I'm pretty clear. I want to be clear in the book early on that when I'm talking about efficiency, I'm talking about informational efficiency. And this is a rather abstract concept, but it basically what it means is how good is a system at processing information. And so when people refer to things like the efficient market hypothesis, what they mean is that markets are very good at translating relevant information about buying and selling assets into actual values of those assets. So it's a pretty smooth translation of information. And we think that that doesn't really happen in governmental systems to the same degree. And so that's what we mean. When I say efficiency, I'm just simply meaning that informational efficiency, that translation of informational inputs into policy outputs.
And there's no efficiency has nothing to do with any normative arguments about good or bad policy. It's simply about the ability to process this information.
Yeah. And so far as I look in the book, now I think it's not too much of a stretch to make a normative argument. I mean, I think given the choice between more informationally efficient systems and less informationally efficient systems, we would choose greater efficiency. But there may be trade-offs. I mean, governments do a lot of complicated things. Governments are concerned with things like justice and fairness, and they're not just trying to be the most efficient. They're also trying to be the most equitable and things like that. And so if there's trade-offs there, well, then we would have to take those seriously.
Yeah, this comes up a lot in studies of punctuated equilibrium. And I think I'd almost take a stronger stance on this. So I look at the city of Austin. City of Austin, we've had tremendous economic growth over the last 10 years or so. And as a result, we have a transportation problem. We don't have enough roads. And if 10 years, when we started to see that trend developing, the city of Austin had reacted, you know, with the distribution of changes available to it and begun building roads, we wouldn't have as much traffic as we have right now. And you can see this come up in area after area. So, I mean, I think we can say that efficient. There is a level of efficiency here, and maybe we shouldn't expect a perfectly normal distribution of changes. But some of the states you're looking at are very, very far from normal in terms of their budget, their budgetary changes at least.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I didn't mean to suggest that there aren't. I think there really are major consequences to these things. The question, and you raised this, is to what extent can we be hopeful? I mean, how many reforms can government actually put in place that are going to allow them to do better at this? Because really, they do have, even a local government has a pretty difficult job when you consider all the problems they could be attending to. And I think there is a certain degree of natural complexity that makes it very difficult. Now, that said, I think, and this is one of the things I talk about in the book, we do have to look at policies or institutions like non-professional legislatures. And I think we do have to seriously consider, well, what does that mean for a state like Texas, our ability of our state legislators to sort of anticipate problems and respond to them maybe ahead of time or as they're happening. And one of the things I show in the books is that the states that have the non-professional legislatures, you actually do tend to see more punctuations, which appear to be sort of overcorrections.
So I'd like to ask you about that really quickly, because one thing I think about with Texas is that although we have a non-professional legislature, we also have an incredibly powerful executive branch. The executive branch power is not nested in the governor's office. It's nested in a series of elected officials. So, I mean, is there like a hidden trade-off that exists in some of these places where the system has adjusted to find that capacity elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a good point. And so that goes slightly beyond the scope of the book, but I think that is the natural thing that happens is that there is a certain, whether you have a non-professional legislature or not, the problems are the same, and you've got to figure out a way as a responsible government to try to solve those problems. And so that may mean you put more power in the hands of the executives. Another thing that it's typically meant is that for the states with the non-professional legislatures is that you have more power with interest groups, or at least they have more control over the information that is being received and processed by legislators, because the legislature might not have any independent research capacity, which makes them quite reliant on whatever interest groups want to tell them.
Taking this in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
One of the things in your chapter on pathologies of decision making, that might not be exactly the title, but
pretty close.
Something like that. You actually have a quick study on presidential elections that I thought had some interesting implications. Do you want to summarize that?
Sure. Yeah. So what I do in that chapter is I look at elections as being one of these types of political decisions where it maybe adheres closer to the collective decision-making model than the deliberative one, in the sense that the electoral outcomes are the result of millions of independent voters making their own semi-autonomous decisions, and then we aggregate all that together to figure out who wins the election. Now, that's not obviously exactly like the stock market, but it's closer to that than the type of deliberation that would typically take place within a legislative session. And so what you see is that electoral changes in two-party vote over time, these tend to be relatively stable, normally distributed, and again, not a whole lot of punctuations, which would indicate that there is some degree of informational efficiency when we aggregate out and look at electoral systems. Yeah.
I mean, but your book seems to indicate that it's not completely normal, that presidential elections specifically do actually seem to have some collective decision results, which to me seems to imply that there's actually a moderating effect process.
You mean the presidential debates, or
yeah? So if deliberative, kind of. Counter to this is deliberative decision making, which is everybody kind of talking about it.
I think the book is all about relative degrees of informational efficiency. I don't think any of our systems, any human system, is going to reach perfect informational efficiency. The market it's not the perfect efficiency market hypothesis, and even the market doesn't get there. And I think certainly presidential elections don't quite get there either. And the big problem we have there, and to a somewhat lesser degree with the market, is that, of course, voters are not independent actors. We are highly influenced by what our peers are doing. And that means that we are susceptible to the type of herd mentality. And this is the same type of mentality that may create a market bubble. Now, I don't know if anyone's directly sort of used that analogy in terms of presidential races, but you could see the same type of phenomenon there. So I didn't mean to imply that any of these processes are perfectly efficient, but it's just that we see less of this dichotomy between stasis and punctuation than we would when we're looking at government systems.
So I'd like to move on to talk about your conclusion. And Katie's got a few questions here, but I'll just want to start off with an overall question here. Is deliberation bad?
No, deliberation it's not bad. It's not. I think, in fact, deliberation is basically inevitable. I mean, there's a lot of decisions that we have to make that are not simply going to be solved. There's just simply no collective mechanism that we could impose over them. And so I think, you lose some informational efficiency, but it's fairly unavoidable. In the book, I actually talk a little bit about, like, well, what would a system of like budgeting that was based on collective decision making look like? And you could imagine that you allow every member of Congress to allocate some certain amount of funds, and then the total budget is just all of those allocations put together. And so then each member of Congress would have to make very strategic decisions about how do I want to allocate my portion of this budget. I don't know. I don't think the federal government is going to test that experiment anytime soon, but it would be interesting to look at what that kind of process would look like. But I do think realistically the role for collective decision making, I think it's important to recognize the informational gains that can be made through this type of decision making, but I think its role in setting public policy is probably always going to be somewhat circumspect. Now, with that said, things like exchange rates, I mean, that's some serious policy. I mean, that's an important chunk of the economy. And so it's not that it's zero, but it's not like we can replace all deliberative decision making with a more collective process.
So this example that you just gave on the budget, do you imagine, and this is, of course, an experiment, in a theoretical experiment at this point, but do you think that would work with policy as well if all the members kind of separately came to a conclusion?
See, there it's harder to envision what that would look like. I mean, the budget, you can sort of imagine it because, it's dollars, it's quantitative. A policy, if you're going to set an abortion policy, you couldn't use collective decision making because that's all about what is fair, what is just, what is right, and so I think you're not going to replace. There's obviously a major role for deliberation in the way policy is made. So that's one of the lessons of the book, and in fact, not just the book, but sort of this entire field of literature, is that to some degree that it's baked into the system, these punctuations, and so we just have to sort of recognize them for what they are and realize that this is a limitation of governance to some degree.
I think one of the last questions that I kind of have for you is what is the most compelling question that formed for you as you were writing this book or as you finished this research?
Yeah, that is a good question. The most compelling question that formed for me, I think it's just this question of how much do we want our governments to engage in information, and what the consequences are of maybe turning away from information. And this isn't a trend I talk about in the book, but it's true, is that we've seen sort of a decline in the analytic capacity of government and a decrease in what might be called technocratic policymaking or honest numbers policymaking, and a rise of more ideological policymaking. And so I think it's interesting to consider what that kind of shift, moving away from an information-based model, what that means for our policies, both substantively and normatively, but also how our policies are going to change over time. And you imagine that we might end up with a government that is surprised by sudden policy crises more often than we might have had otherwise.
Derek, thank you for joining us. Everybody, the book is The Structure of Policy Change. I highly recommend it. And we'll put all the links in the descriptions for this podcast to that book. Katie, thank you for joining me as well.
Thank you.
And this has been your Policy Agenda podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.